greetings. Welcome back. This is the Advisor Pact monthly session. I'm Mark Little. We got several questions this month. I've chosen two for us to deal with today. And just a reminder, the purpose of this program, the Advisor Pact monthly program, is for financial advisors who are working with families and individuals with the goal of delivering truly comprehensive financial services. So then what's the Advisor Pact? Well, the Advisor Pact represents the four client expectations that in our research, it has become clearer and clearer over the years that these are the four commitments that if you will make to an ideal client at the point of the initial, inception of the relationship, that when you begin delivering truly comprehensive financial services, if you will make this Advisor Pact, then these are the four things that clients have told us over and over that they cannot find anywhere at any price from any advisor. So by making this Advisor Pact to each and every one of your ideal clients, you will be in the process of radically differentiating yourself from any other advisor that this client has ever met or will ever meet. Your commitment is to protect them, to honestly protect their financial assets and their financial strategy from anyone that might create an obstacle or a potential conflict of interest, that you will pay close attention to their situations so they don't have to worry whether you're on top of their issues or not. You have created a process to make sure that you are aware enough about the ongoings of their financial affairs so that you will recognize the need for regular course corrections and will make recommendations to correct course whenever it's required for the client to remain on track to their goals. As far as coordination, you commit to coordinating all the financial products and financial people in the client's life, and you will make sure that no recommendation comes before the client as a formal recommendation and until and unless you have coordinated that recommendation to make sure that it is perfectly aligned with the overarching strategy which you and your team have created for this client. And then finally, transparency. It's appalling how many clients, and I mean affluent clients, really don't clearly understand exactly how they're paying for the financial products and people in their lives. And you are committing to full transparency. Your clients, and you're committing, you're making a pact, a pledge with each client that that they will completely and fully understand exactly what they're paying for every financial person in their life and every financial product that they own. And if you will make this pact and agree to implement truly comprehensive financial services under the context of this pledge, you will be in the process of becoming a category of one. It will not be a choice between you and some other financial advisor that an affluent person could work with. You'll be the only game in town. There will not be any other advisors who are willing and able to do these four things under the context of truly comprehensive financial services, which is quite simply coordinating all the financial affairs for a client, not just pieces and parts, but everything financial. You'll handle all the money stuff, and the client agrees to then go off and live a great life because they've got a team that they can trust who's truly competent to coordinate all their financial affairs. Now, I mentioned there were two issues that came in that I selected for us to deal with today. The first one was a trusted advisor who is in the process of interviewing for a financial planner and wants to know how to make sure when he finds a good one. Okay, so how do you know that the financial planner you're interviewing is actually a good financial planner? And then the second question that came in from a trusted advisor in the program was just a question. What are the benefits of truly comprehensive financial services? It's not easy to implement what we're talking about here. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of time to get it all into place. So the question is, what are the benefits to the client? If you make the effort to put all this together, you know, what is it that you can articulate to your clients and potential clients as to what it is that they're actually going to get for the money that they're paying you? And we'll cover these two today. So this question in from a trusted advisor. I'm interviewing a financial planning subject matter expert. How do I make sure the person that I'm interviewing is a good financial planner? Now, that's a great question, because your team and your services and whether or not your clients are impressed with what you've put together in terms of the services you're providing really hinges on this. And it's not just your financial planning subject matter expert. It's all your subject matter experts. So let's talk about how to make sure when you're interviewing subject matter experts, how do you make sure that that the individuals, the professionals that you're interviewing are good? And as you're interviewing a number of candidates to fill each and every subject matter expert role, how do you narrow it down to make sure that you're selecting only the most skilled professional? I think the way to approach this question is to start at the beginning and to just acknowledge how different what you're building is. When you come across affluent people, the traditional financial services model, in other words, the way that the average client is structured before you come along, is like this. If the client has a team, in other words, they typically do have financial people in their lives before you come along, maybe a tax accountant, certainly their money is parked somewhere. It's maybe at a bank or it's with some kind of a money manager or maybe in mutual funds or something. So there is some money management structure before you came along typically. There may or may not be a financial planner. There almost always is a lawyer hanging in the wings, somebody that created wills and trusts for them, even if it's many years ago. And of course, every client has insurance agents, auto and homeowners and life insurance and so forth. So there are financial people in their life. But the point is, if there's any coordination of these people, it's the client who does it. All these professionals are tied directly to the client. And so the two overarching questions are, is there an overarching strategy to align and focus this team? In other words, does the team know what the objectives are? Is there anybody creating a strategy to pull these people together so that they can focus their efforts and their recommendations on the accomplishment of something? Financial goals, financial objectives, and so forth. So does this exist? Usually it doesn't. And to what extent are these individuals, these professionals being coordinated? So does the tax person ever talk to any of the other subject matter experts? Does the money manager or the attorney or the insurance agents, do they ever coordinate with each other on crossover issues? The typical scenario is, if there's any coordination at all, which typically there's not, they typically don't talk to each other. But if they do, it's coordinated by the client. It's the client who's twisting their arm to contact each other. In other words, nobody on the team has ever stepped up in the average client's life and said, "Hey, I think all of us should talk to each other," and takes up the leadership role to make sure that everybody's talking to each other before recommendations are made. It just typically doesn't happen. So the critical questions are, in the traditional financial services model, in other words, just an average affluent person, these should be the critical questions in their mind as they're thinking about how to improve their financial affairs. The question is, who's establishing the overall strategy? Usually there's nobody, or if there's anybody, and typically the client even if it's for ego's sake, they won't admit that there is no strategy. Most clients will say, even if in fact there is no strategy in place, they will say, I'm in charge of the strategy. So the answer to the question in the traditional financial services model is typically that the client is the one who establishes the strategy, not the team. And frankly, there is no strategy, but that is a question. Is there a strategy and who establishes it? And once there's a strategy in place, who provides oversight to make sure that all the recommendations that are coming out of each of these professionals, the tax recommendations, the insurance agents making recommendations, the lawyers, you know, making recommendations to create and amend and update wills and trusts, and of course the money manager or somebody's moving money around periodically. So the question is, who's providing any oversight? So when a recommendation is made, who's ever looking at this to make sure that the recommendations, first of all, are good ones? And second of all, who's providing oversight to make sure that every recommendation is perfectly aligned with the overarching strategy? The answer to the question is typically not good. It's usually there is no oversight. And third, who's responsible for measuring success? So who is the individual on the team that regularly is going to report back to the client whether we are on track or are not on track to the objectives? So if you have an overarching strategy and there is oversight to make sure that every recommendation's perfectly aligned with the strategy, then who's responsible for standing up and saying we are on track or we aren't on track and here's what we need to do to get back on track? And usually the answer to all three of these questions is it's either very foggy or non-existent. These are the three things that aren't typically happening in the traditional financial services model. So in steps you, and your business model is radically different. You're coming in with a completely different approach. Rather than the client coordinating all the financial people in their life, there you are coming, proposing a business model where you are the single simple point of contact for the client. You will be the individual who will help the client establish objectives and understand what the goals are, and then make sure that there is an oversight team in place that is coordinated by the advisor so that the client doesn't have to, and that the trusted advisor is making sure that everybody on the oversight team is completely clear on what the client's objectives are. And then the team goes about to create an overarching strategy, what we call a comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy. So the point of this entire narration is that the quality of this team that you're going to put together, the tax subject matter expert, the money management subject matter expert, the financial planning subject matter expert, the legal or estate planning subject matter expert, and then the insurance subject matter expert. This is your oversight team that is going to coordinate and provide oversight to create the plan for the client, the lifetime plan, and then to hold the client's financial people, their insurance agents, their tax accountant, and so forth. You know, these uncoordinated people, they may be great tacticians, but they have typically no strategy. It's your team that's going to create the strategy and then provide the oversight over what we call the implementation team, which is the client's existing financial people. This business model will put you in a category of one. There will be no other financial advisor likely in your area that is capable or even willing or interested in doing this level of service and providing this level of oversight. So the quality of the team that you put together, this oversight team, is really what's going to determine whether or not you are of value to your clients. So it's a high stakes proposition to recruit carefully and to make sure that you are inviting onto your team only those professionals that are sufficiently skilled to actually make a difference in the client's life and to provide proper oversight and to create the overarching strategy and basically to deliver truly comprehensive financial services as a team. So let's talk about how you recruit these five subject matter experts. There is, as you know, a 12-step process for recruiting each subject matter expert. We call this the deliverables team recruitment process. And we've, and you know, we're, it's not the purpose here to go in detail through each of the 12 steps, but I do want to fly through it so that you're at least aware of how this 12-step process works. And by the way, this entire 12-step process was designed to be implemented within 60 days. So that's just another way of saying that when you implement this deliverables team recruitment process, this 12-step process, it's important that it be implemented and managed to a 60-day timeline. Because otherwise, like any project, it could expand into whatever time's available. So you could take a year implementing these 12 steps. And so the point is that this process is designed to be managed very tightly by an individual to make sure that the entire 12 steps are accomplished in 60 days or less. That means you're acquiring a top-notch, an A player, subject matter expert every 60 days at a minimum. And so the 12 steps are, just to fly through them, the first step is to identify the subject matter expert role that you're going to fill next. And so we recommend, the way the whole process is designed, is you don't try to fill several subject matter expert roles at one time. You focus on one role at a time, and you interview a number of candidates. And so so you identify the vacancy on your team that that you need to fill, and you focus on filling that single vacancy until it's filled. So you identify the role. You then create what we call a best-in-class profile. You could call it a position description, but it's a documented profile of exactly what you're looking for, the skills of the candidates that you're looking for, what skills, what experience, and exactly what they'll be doing when they come to join your team. So you create that profile, then you begin developing a list of candidates. So this is important to make sure that you have plenty of people to interview. We recommend that you do not fill any subject matter expert position until you've interviewed enough candidates to where you have at least three that you would be willing to hire. And so so if you keep interviewing until you have three candidates that you'd be willing to hire, then you'll be able to select among those three the single best, most skilled, top-notch candidate. Once you've got your candidate list, you have not contacted any of them yet. Your team, your administrative manager, does initial research, you know, Googles them, looks at their website. You know, this is before any contact is made to the individual or the candidate, unless they've contacted you. But in any event, there's some initial research, background research done on each candidate. Then there's a research call, again, not contacting the candidate, but a call into their firm, a call to the receptionist in their office, an attempt to get additional information about, you know, whether they're accepting clients and if they have any collateral marketing material. Just this is done by your administrative manager, a research call into their firm just to understand the scope of services that they provide and get a little research, some additional research on the firm and on the candidate. Then you have the first contact with the candidate. This is by the trusted advisor, not by the team. This is a call from the trusted advisor into the firm to reach the candidate to schedule an initial discovery meeting. So you schedule a bunch. At this point, you have a bunch of candidates on the list. You've done a bunch of research, and you've got, in essence, the list of candidates prioritized. So as you're doing research, you prioritize the candidates so that the best candidates are at the top of the list, and then the advisor begins going through the list and calling each candidate and scheduling an initial sit-down meeting. We call that the initial discovery meeting. So that's the first time you meet. If it's a local subject matter expert candidate, you'll meet face-to-face. We recommend this meeting be in a neutral location, not in your office, not in their office, but in a neutral location, so that if they end up being not a good candidate, you can just politely rise and shake their hand and say, "Hey, it's been great meeting you," and you can disengage very quickly, get back to the office, and get back to your day. So you have an initial discovery meeting in a neutral location. Then the second meeting with the client is something called the best-in-class assessment meeting, where you've eliminated the candidates that you just don't think are a good fit. In that initial discovery meeting, one of the big purposes of that meeting is to eliminate candidates. And so the best-in-class assessment is the second meeting with every candidate, but you only proceed with those candidates that really looked good. So of the candidates that have not been screened out, you have a best-in-class assessment meeting. This meeting's in their office, not yours. Now, of course, if these are virtual candidates, if these are subject matter experts who live somewhere else in another city, then these have to be, of course, online meetings or phone calls. We recommend online meetings. So this best-in-class assessment meeting should be in their office, unless it's a virtual candidate, in which case you have an online meeting set up to assess their skills and make sure that they are the real deal and that they are truly at the level that they need to be to join your team. Then you kind of withdraw. Now you've met with all your candidates. You've met with them to determine their skills and their client deliverables and to determine if they're good enough to be on your team. And now you narrow down and you are in the process of selecting the ones or the one that will likely join your team. We recommend that you have an internal agreement meeting where you sit down with your existing team. If you've been building a team and you have some subject matter experts, this is the point you get them involved, and you lay it out. You share the file. You share your research on each candidate. You tell your own team the one that you think is the top candidate, and if you've narrowed it down to two or three, you make this meeting all about discussing the top three and determining which one to select. And then you send them away, your team, after this meeting. You get their input, their feedback. You give them the recording of the meeting. By the way, you record every single one of these meetings. So you give them copies of the best-in-class assessment meeting recording. And then your team does their own research. They reach out to their network, and they try to establish the reputation of the candidate, the top candidates that you've narrowed it down to. And then at the end of the day, you're looking for your team to agree with you on a single candidate. So the whole purpose of the internal agreement meeting is for your team to agree upon a single candidate. Then you bring that candidate into your office. This deal structure meeting is a meeting with the finalist in your office, where you share with them, hey, our team has met. We are very impressed with you. Of all the candidates we interviewed, you're the one. You're the one we would like to structure a deal with and invite you to join our team. And the deal structure meeting is where you actually sit down, lay out what's expected, what you expect of them, and you talk money. You figure out how you're going to pay them. So typically the deal is structured in this meeting, but there's a bunch of loose ends that need to happen at this point. At this point, you're negotiating on fees and so forth and how the compensation will go. And so you'll typically leave this meeting with a handshake agreement that you agree to work together, but maybe you have some details to hammer out. For one thing, they need to document their process using the best way method that we have, that we require. We want to actually see their process documented. They have to go through the orientation process to work on our team, and we have a subject matter expert agreement form that they need to sign. So in other words, you walk away from the deal structure meeting with, in essence, a handshake and with an agreement to basically finalize the agreement, which is the next step. You get them oriented. You have them sign the subject matter expert agreement form, which is just the making sure they understand what you expect of them. But also you finalize the compensation and all the details. You wrap up all the final details and finalize the agreement. And then the last step in the process is to then present an agreement. So to reduce everything to writing, this may be a formal agreement drawn up by your lawyer. That's what we do. That's what we recommend. But even if it's a handshake agreement, you need to kind of spell out, you know, reduce it to writing exactly what you expect and how the, you know, how the relationship might be terminated. If that ever came to that, you need to, you know, this is a professional arrangement and you need to reduce everything to writing. And so you present the agreement. So that's the 12 steps. Those are all 12 steps. And notice me walking through that whole thing there. There were only three meetings. So the whole process, yes, there's 12 steps, but when you start meeting with candidates, there's really just three meetings with each candidate. And of course, the process is designed to eliminate candidates along the way so that you're narrowing it down and then, you know, proceeding only with the best candidates. So you have the initial discovery meeting that's in a neutral location just to see if they're a good fit, make sure you get along, and for them to have enough of a conversation so they understand what you're looking for and they get an opportunity to share a thumbnail sketch of their skills so that you're convinced enough that they're a good fit to proceed. The second meeting is in their office where they convince you. It's really the ball's in their court to convince you of their skill. And then the third meeting is to narrow it down to a single candidate and have the deal structure meeting to cut a deal. Now, the meeting that answers the question that you ask, how do I know if this is a good subject matter expert or not? It's this best in class assessment meeting. So I want to spend just a couple of minutes walking through that one meeting, because it's really different than anything that you've ever done before in terms of talking to a professional. And I just want to walk through that meeting so that you understand how different it is and how high stakes it is. Because there's a right way to conduct the best in class assessment meeting, and there's a wrong way. Now, as I said, make sure that you record this and every meeting with every candidate. Now, this meeting is not, I repeat, not about you sharing your process or your vision for what you're going to be delivering to clients. This meeting is not for telling them what you want from them. This meeting is all about them convincing you that they're sufficiently skilled, not the other way around. So they are on stage. That is to say, the candidate, you're meeting in their office. They're the ones that are on stage, not you. The onus in this meeting is on them to impress you and for them to perform in this meeting, not for you to perform in this meeting. So one of the skill assessments for you is, as you do more and more of these best-in-class assessment meetings, is to go back and listen to the recording and sit there with a timer. And this is clearly a situation where in this meeting, since the onus is on them to impress you, you should be timing how much time you're talking and how much time they're talking. They definitely should be talking 80% or more of the time. So again, this meeting is to assess their process and for you to convince yourself that this candidate is sufficiently skilled. And you can only assess that if they're talking. You'll not be able to assess them if you are talking. So the first thing you do when you walk into the meeting, and again, if it's a virtual meeting, you'll have to do this as an online meeting, and the outcomes are the same. You just it's just you have to do it as an online meeting if the candidate is somewhere outside your city. And if this relationship is going to be a virtual relationship. But if it's a local relationship, as you walk in the door, and I'm going to assume for the rest of this conversation that this is an in-office meeting. You've scheduled this best-in-class assessment meeting in their office. And the very first thing you are to do is to verify something that you should have already confirmed in the initial discovery meeting. And that is that this candidate has at least 2 administrative support people. In other words, we recommend that be a deal breaker, and that it's an easy question to add to your talking points in the first meeting, which is the initial discovery meeting, just to ask them how many administrative support people do you have supporting you. And what you're looking for is that they've been in business a while, they have existing clients, and if they don't have at least 2 administrative people supporting them, then just take a pass. Don't even schedule the best in class assessment meeting. Only proceed with candidates if they have at least 2 administrative support people. So the first thing you do is to meet, as you walk through the doors, you meet the candidate's team and you tour their business. So you're in their office, you know, you get the cook's tour. You basically, meet all the people that are working for them and get a brief thumbnail sketch, understanding of what each one of them does, and you kind of tour their business just to understand, see their operation. Now, in terms of outcomes, what are you actually trying to accomplish in this meeting? There's several outcomes, and one of them is that you need to confirm that this candidate is already working with people who meet your ideal client profile. So you need to be a little bit careful about this, because if you don't word this carefully and properly, your candidate will get the wrong meaning from this conversation. You're there for the purpose of assessing their process, and you're not going to walk out the door until you've documented the candidate's full process for working with their clients. You're not going to walk out the door until you've documented every step in their process, and that includes all their processes and all their client deliverables. You're going to make sure that you understand everything that they deliver to their clients, because what you're looking for is to hire. You're looking for the best candidate that you can hire to deliver these services to your ideal clients. So when you're confirming that the candidate commonly works with clients who meet your ideal client profile, what you're really trying to find out is how many clients are they currently working with that actually meet your ideal client profile. Now, I say be cautious, because you don't want them to have the mistaken understanding that this is in any way a referral arrangement. In other words, what you don't do in this process, and we recommend this very strenuously, is you do not even talk about referrals at this stage. If they bring it up, you tell them we're getting way ahead of ourselves, and you reset the conversation to confirm, no, what I am looking for is the best candidate that I can hire to serve my clients in this field of finance. And I'm trying to assess your process. I want to know everything that you do for clients, so that if I hand you one of my ideal clients, I know your whole process, I know all your client deliverables, and I'm convinced that you're the real deal, that you're highly skilled and you've got a really robust process already in place. And I want to make sure that when I hand you my ideal clients, that this is not a new experience for you. So I'm simply trying to confirm that you commonly work with clients who meet my ideal client profile. So you come prepared with your ideal client profile, you show it to them, and yes, I don't walk out of that meeting without knowing roughly how many clients they currently have that meet my ideal client profile. And I'm prepared for them to say, so this is a referral. You're expecting me to refer my clients back to you? And you say, no, that's not what this is about. I would not hedge on that. I think the tendency for many advisors is to say, well, of course we would welcome referrals. No, take that whole issue off the table. We recommend saying no. What we are looking for is the best candidate to hire to provide these services to our clients. So I am looking to hire a subject matter expert. I just don't want to hire one if they're not used to commonly working with people that meet my ideal client profile. So how many people are you currently working with that meet this profile? And get that clear. And so your one outcome is to make sure that they have a lot of clients that meet your ideal client profile. So for the purpose of just making sure that this is a professional that your clients will be very comfortable with, because this professional is used to working with people like your clients. And then secondly, you need to make sure that before you leave the meeting, you have a complete and clear and full understanding of this candidate's full process. So you document their process. By the way, just let me put that on pause long enough to say, you may be thinking, shouldn't I just ask them for their documented process? And the answer is yes. We always ask them, can I see your process? But I'm preparing you that even if this candidate is the real deal, and even if they are extraordinarily skilled, I have become accustomed over the years, over the decades of doing this, that very few subject matter experts actually have something that they can or are willing to give you in terms of an already documented process. Yes, they may have processes. It may be checklists inside of electronic systems they have in their office. Or everybody on their team may have processes that they are accustomed to following that they just can't provide you in a form that you can look at. So I'm just used to the notion that I'm the one that's going to have to sit down in a bullet point fashion with a blank sheet of paper and say, so what's your process? And have them carefully walk through their process. I'm going to be the one on my pad of paper having to make bullet points and carefully walking as they walk me through their process. I'm going to be the one who has to play scribe. And that's my goal, is I don't want to walk out the door until I have a bullet pointed list of very carefully and thoroughly documenting everything that they would be doing for my clients. That means documenting their entire process, including every single client deliverable. I want to map out. In addition to that, I do several passes of this. So I ask them big picture, and I'll document everything they say. Then I'll go back and say, what are your client deliverables? And they'll think for a minute, and they may even ask you, what's a client deliverable? And it's basically you tell them that, you know, what is it that you do for your clients? So what is it that every client can expect that they're going to get from you, and that's a client deliverable. And so I go back through in a second pass and document those client deliverables. Then I'll do a third pass, and I'll say, so let's take it another way. Let's think about a new client. They walk in your door for the very first time. Let's go step by step through what you do with a brand new client. You know, how do you get up to speed with that client's situation? What's your process? I want to map out the first 12 months of your process with a brand new client. So I go through it a third time and see if I can pick up some additional bullet points on my little list that I'm maintaining. And then basically, you know, the purpose of this meeting is to thoroughly and carefully walk step by step through their entire process so that you understand both the quality and the quantity of the services that your clients would be receiving from this subject matter expert. Then you go back to your office and you sit down with your team and you assess this candidate's process along with everybody else, every other candidate that you've gotten to this point. And so with each of the candidates, you've documented their process. Now, I'm telling you, if you do this four or five times, you'll come up with three candidates that will really stand up head and shoulders above the others. Some candidates, even if they're pretty good at what they do, their inability to document their process or their clumsiness in being able to walk you through what every client actually receives for the money that they're paying this subject matter expert is going to be, you know, shockingly inadequate in some cases. And so that's fine. You just do the best you can. You map it out. Again, this is the onus is on them. They've got to impress you, and either they do or they don't. And don't be surprised if even subject matter experts that came to you with supposedly stellar reputations, like really well known in town, but when you sit down and make them actually walk you through their process so that you're documenting exactly what your clients would be receiving from them, just be prepared. Some are just woefully inadequate. They don't seem to either know what they're doing, or they just don't have a very good process, or they can't articulate their process. In other words, they don't seem to be the real deal. My point is, after you've done a half a dozen of these interviews, you know, the goal is two or three, really, you need to keep interviewing candidates until at least three really stand out from the crowd. And if you don't have any that are standing out from the crowd, just keep interviewing. Just keep interviewing candidates, and eventually you'll have three that really impress you. So you go back with your team, existing team, such as it is. It may just be you and your administrative manager at the very beginning, but at some point you'll have subject matter experts that can help you assess what you've documented as far as their process in the best in class assessment meeting. We call this the BICA, by the way, best in class assessment meeting, best in class assessment, BICA. Anyway, You go back to your office, and your goal is to ensure that this candidate's process is more robust than your deliverables checkpoints. So you have deliverables checkpoints that you'll be assigning to this subject matter expert within their narrow field of finance. Your goal is to go back to the office, look at everything you've documented, all these little bullet points of their process and their deliverables and, you know, the first 12 months of a client relationship. And you're going to look at everything you documented that they do for clients, and you're going to make sure that their process is more robust than yours. If your deliverables checkpoints for their narrow field of finance ends up being look at the two and your process is more robust than theirs, well, then you take a pass. You do not proceed with that candidate. Now, that being said, you may notice a couple of things, maybe an item or two or three that just somehow are glaring omissions, like they just didn't mention it. I think it is okay to have a follow-up phone call if there are just, you know, one or two or three things on your list that they just never mentioned. And it's okay to contact them and say, hey, I noticed that you didn't talk about, and then just mention something that maybe is one of your deliverables checkpoints that did not make it on their list or that they did never mention. And this allows them an opportunity to say, oh, yeah, we always do that. Or I did actually say that, but I called it something else. You'll hear it a variety of different responses. But if it turns out that whatever you're calling to check on to see if maybe it was a gap in their services, as long as they resolve it to your satisfaction, then you're still good. So you may notice a couple of gaps in their process that you can go back and check on, and it may be that they just either failed to mention it or they mentioned it, but they called it something else. And so you do need to clear that up. And then basically you ask yourself, once you're convinced that that candidate has a process more robust than your checklist for them, then you just have to ask yourself and your team, will this subject matter expert actually impress my ideal clients? Kind of wipe away all the complexity and just think at the simplest level. Is this individual impressive? Is this individual an A player? Will my clients be impressed because this person's on my team? They definitely have to not only pull their weight, but they have to be independently impressive. And the goal with every ideal client is for the client to view you and your team as indispensable. And I think you need to, after you've convinced yourself that this candidate is both skilled and their process is more robust than yours, and that they are impressive, you know, I think the bottom line question in your mind is, If this were my only subject matter expert, let's say there was a catastrophic event and somehow all my other subject matter experts were not available to use for this particular client on an issue, maybe. If all I had was this particular subject matter expert, would this subject matter expert as a standalone individual, standalone professional, would the client consider my services indispensable because of this single professional? And what you're looking for is, yes, you want every single individual subject matter expert to think that every ideal client would consider our team indispensable if all we had was any one of these subject matter experts, so that as a collection, having all of them is just mind-blowing. The service that they will provide as a team is going to be outstanding, because each of them as individuals would be considered indispensable by my clients. So I think the point I want to make sure is that that you recognize that this best-in-class assessment meeting, this BICA, is all about them. You don't perform, that you don't basically come to this meeting to tell them what you're looking for. It's up to them to clarify their skill. They need to walk you through their process. Now, after this best-in-class assessment meeting, after the meeting is completed, then it's okay to share your process with the candidate. You can carefully walk them through how, you know, the three-meeting process and everything that you do or intend to do with clients. But the point is, don't show your cards until this candidate has shown theirs. Don't show them what your deliverables checkpoints are. Don't show them what your process is in detail. You can in general in the first meeting, but basically don't show your cards until this candidate has convinced you that basically two things. Number one is they routinely work with clients who already meet your ideal client profile, and they've convinced you that their process is highly organized, skilled, and that their process is much more robust than the deliverables checkpoints you will be assigning to them. So the point is your deliverables checkpoints will only be a safety net for them. You're only acquiring subject matter experts whose process is already just impressive. So that's the 12-step process. These are the three meetings that you'll meet with each candidate if they keep moving forward in the process. And this best-in-class assessment meeting is the key meeting that they have to perform. They have to convince you that they are up to the task. And the ball's in their court to do that, not yours. So we have a question that came in from a trusted advisor. What are actually the client benefits of truly comprehensive financial services? It's a really great question. We talk about this in from different angles. I always love it when a question comes in that's very similar or common to questions that we get, but maybe worded in a little bit different way. So if you think about truly comprehensive financial services from a client standpoint, in other words, client benefit language, it's my belief that there are three bottom line client outcomes to truly comprehensive financial services. Yes, you could make a case, and you'd be right, that advisor pact, you know, just the four client expectations that you're pledging to provide to each ideal client, and that you will be delivering, in other words, protection, you're going to pay attention, you're going to do full coordination of all areas of their financial life, and full transparency. Yes, those are benefits, no question. But I think when you ask the question this way, what are the client benefits of truly comprehensive financial services? I think those four advisor pact pledges actually end up being more of at an emotional level, that when let's say a year into the relationship, as they look back over the relationship and they're assessing in their own minds what it is that they like about you, the fact that you protect them, that you pay close attention, that you're coordinating everything with full transparency, you know, this is really kind of at a visceral and an emotional level. This is how they feel, and this is what they were always looking for but could never find. But I think if you ask them this question, what are the actual benefits? So if you were to be able to, in your mind, clearly articulate to your team, what is it that we do for clients? What's the outcome to them? And if you were to have a conversation with clients, maybe over dinner, about what they feel, and I think if you were having a conversation back and forth, if you were to position it as in proposing these three bottom line client outcomes, I think they would agree. And by the way, if clients can get clear on these three outcomes, and if they agree that they are receiving these three bottom line client outcomes from you as a result of truly comprehensive financial services, this also becomes the way that your clients will articulate what you do when they're introducing you to others that they think you should be working with, in other words, referrals. So whether you're communicating and articulating the value of truly comprehensive financial services to your team so that they step up and deliver at a higher level, these are the three outcomes. If you're just having a conversation informally with a client so that you're talking and they're talking and you're really more interested in how they feel, but if they ask you, what do you think the outcome, you know, the benefits are, these are the three outcomes that if they agree that this is what they're getting and they value it highly as they should, this has a third benefit of helping the client kind of script in their own mind. Rick Barrera calls this lip loading, I think is what he calls it. Anyway, it's helping the clients kind of load up in their mind what it is, how to articulate what they're already feeling about the benefits of what they're receiving from you. So what are they? What are these three client outcomes? I believe there are three bottom line client outcomes to truly comprehensive financial services. One is, for clients to know that they're on track to their goals. You know, what's it worth to a client to remain on track to their goals and to know at all times that they're on track to their goals? The second is proactiveness on financial issues. In other words, being ahead of issues, not behind issues. And the third is to make smart choices about your money in all areas of finance to make better financial decisions along the way. So let's delve into these a little bit more in detail. To kind of think about each one of them, this remaining on track, it's the idea that you're the first person in their life to regularly measure success. That when you sit down, you actually tell the client in the very first moments of every client progress meeting, you know, here's each one of your goals, and you're either on track or off track to each of your goals. And by the way, if you're off track at each meeting, I'm going to recommend for any goal you're off track on, I'm going to recommend whatever recommendations or course corrections that are required to get you back on track. So you can count on me to know that you're on track to all your goals, or if ever anything drifts off track, we'll get you back on track. We're going to notice it, and we're going to get you back on, make recommendations to get you back on track. As far as proactiveness on financial issues, it's this idea that your process is so thorough and it's so far-sighted and so, you know, has so much foresight that you're never going to miss any financial opportunities. So what's it worth to a client to work with an advisor who is so proactive? You and your team are so proactive that no major financial opportunity is ever going to be overlooked or missed, and that there will never be financial surprises. You know, what's it worth to a client to know that there just will not be any financial surprises because the process is so proactive? And then third, this idea of making better financial decisions, what's it worth to a client to make smart choices about your money along the way in all areas of finance? So these are the three client outcomes. Let's take them one at a time because what we're going to wrap up with on this whole idea is that not every client values all three of these equally. I've been in the business for 30 years, and I recognize that some clients value some of these outcomes more than others. For younger, very goal-oriented, aggressive clients, when it comes to their financial objectives, you know, the idea that they have goals and that they're on track to their goals is really their whole life's all about that, and they value that highly. Other people, they're at a point in their life where they've funded all their goals, and maybe their goals are not as important, but the idea of making smart choices about their money along the way is really important. And maybe their biggest concern is, you know, the risk and not losing what they've accumulated. So maybe being proactive on financial issues so that we don't miss opportunities, but mainly there are no surprises, you know, this might be the thing that some clients value. So my point is, some clients may value all three. Most clients will value all three to some extent, some more than others. But every client has to value at least one of these three. And if you have a client or potential client that doesn't value any of these three outcomes, then it's probably not a good relationship. It's not something that you'll be able to fulfill whatever they're looking for. So these are the three outcomes that, put it another way, every client has to value at least one of these outcomes tremendously, enough to pay you your entire fee. And then most clients will value all of them to some extent, and some clients will value all three equally. And so the point is, these are the three outcomes. Let's take them one at a time. Remaining on track to goals. You know, the idea, you know, what's this worth to you as a client? We're going to establish and maintain a plan, something that maybe you've never had, an overarching strategy, a financial strategy, a lifetime strategy for you to achieve your financial objectives by the target date you set. So we're going to have a plan in place to achieve your goals. We're actually going to call this your comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy. So what's it worth to you to have this comprehensive lifetime strategy in place and updated all the time? What's it worth for you once the plan is in place to have somebody in your life that's measuring progress, not benchmarked against the economy, not benchmarked against, you know, the investment benchmarks or investment indexes or anything like that, but no, measured against your goals. Are you on track or off track to achieving your goals by the target date you've set? So what's it worth in your life to have someone that maybe for the first time in your life is really focused on measuring progress against your objectives? And during times when your plan inevitably drifts off track, you know, what's it worth to you to know that we're going to proactively recommend the necessary course corrections to get you back on track? In other words, we're going to pay attention, and if anything ever drifts off track, we're going to notice it, and we're going to get you back on track. So what's that worth to you to know that to know that you're going to remain on track to your goals at all times? Because we've got a process, we're going to meet with you at least once every 4 months to measure progress. And we're going to confirm at least 3 times a year that you're on track. Or if you're off track, we're going to make whatever recommendations are required to get you back on track. What's that worth to you? Now let's talk about being proactive on financial issues. You know, some clients are going to value this tremendously. The fact that you're thinking ahead, you're not reactive, that the client in areas that they control, not focusing on things that the client cannot control, but thankfully there are enough elements in the client's situation that are within their control that you can be proactive and create a plan that is so thorough and so far-sighted that you're going to anticipate financial opportunities way in advance, and you're going to avoid financial surprises. We're going to make sure that you're ahead of financial issues, not behind financial issues, and so that you don't get caught off guard by predictable financial surprises. And the goals for this long-term strategy that we're going to keep updated for you is to never miss any financial opportunity. And what does that mean? What are financial opportunities? Well, the way that we define them is we're on the lookout for things that will accelerate your results. So you've got target dates for every goal. Our objective as a team is to be so proactive that if there is a way to accelerate your results, if only to create a margin of safety so that you achieve your goals sooner, if possible, than you've set as an objective, we're going to notice those things and make those recommendations. So if there are financial opportunities, ways to save taxes, ways to increase your return, anything that we can see as a team that's going to accelerate your results, we're on the lookout. And we're committing to you that that's the goal of being proactive for us, and that they're not going to be surprises. You know, you're not going to have tax surprises, for example. We're going to be so far ahead on every area of your life: tax planning, financial planning, estate planning, money management, insurance, and risk. We're going to look far into the future and make it our goal that you will not have these financial surprises along the way. To the extent that we can plan around them, that's the goal, to be proactive and to avoid any surprises. And then the third and final is just to make better financial decisions. What does that mean? Well, we're going to help you make smart decisions in all areas of finance along the way. So the question becomes, what does that mean? It may be having to do with major purchases. So some clients make a lot of major purchases. They buy vacation homes, they buy boats, they buy airplanes, they buy, you know, major purchases of all kinds. It could be technology, toys, and things. But, you know, maybe we help you select the best method of making major purchases. And that's what we do. Maybe in some clients' cases, it's to decide on risks in your life, whether you should purchase insurance or just self-insure. So maybe we help you make better decisions having to do with how to handle risk. And maybe it's regularly shopping your cash and money market accounts to make sure you're getting the highest interest rates on cash that's just laying around. That's making smart choices about your money. How about creating maturity strategies for time deposits like certificates of deposit or bonds or things like that? So how about having a strategy to make better financial decisions around when these things come due so that they come due according to some strategy and that the money's there when you need them for goals or the money's there when you need it for any cash needs, that we're actually helping you make smart decisions about your money when it comes to maturities or managing healthcare when you're traveling abroad, or how about credit card rewards programs? Depending upon the client, this can be tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. This is something that no advisor has ever offered to help them with. How about making the best decisions when it comes to foreign currencies? If you have a client that travels abroad, how do they handle foreign currency while they're traveling? Get the best exchange rates, or if they're making a large purchase, they're making some sort of a large purchase in foreign currencies. So these are all examples of how you could potentially help a client make smart choices about their money. Also, travel rewards, airline points, and things like that. Again, we have seen clients that have assets in the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars when it comes to travel rewards. No advisor's ever helped a client make smart decisions when it comes to that sort of thing. Creating a crisis plan for accessing finances during a catastrophic event. I live in San Diego in Southern California. I can tell you earthquakes are a concern here in Southern California. So what would be the plan if there was an earthquake and the house got destroyed in an earthquake? But then I grew up in Texas, so we had tornadoes in Texas, and in South Texas we had hurricanes. So wherever you are in the world, there's a potential for a catastrophe. So most clients have never had an advisor who help them make in advance smart choices about money to prepare for crises and disasters and things like that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. My point here is not to go through the entire list, and you may decide not to even do some of these things. The point is, this is what clients think about in terms of a bottom line outcome. For some clients, this idea of having someone at their side helping them make smart choices about their money along the way in all areas of finance is a tremendous value to them. So the three client outcomes are these. What's it worth to you as a client to know that you're always on track to your goals? What's it worth to you as a client to be so proactive, to have an advisor that's got a process that's so proactive that there are never any surprises? And what's it worth to you as a client to make better financial decisions and to know that you're making smart choices about your money in all areas of finance? So I think just to wrap this up, this is what we do. It's what you articulate to your team. It's if you get into a casual conversation with a client and they start talking about what they value about you, that is far more important than anything you would ever say. But I'm telling you that when they're finished talking, if they truly value what you do, it's going to be in one of or more or all of these three areas, and your ability to articulate what they just said back to them in a way that they could then articulate it back to others that they refer to you is of tremendous value. So it's your ability to articulate, this is what we do. And your annual compensation, what clients pay you, is actually to deliver these three outcomes. And any other services that they want you to do, like you have the client that comes in after a cocktail party saying, hey, my brother-in-law recommends this some wacky investment. could you look at it for me? That's beyond the scope. I mean, we basically are focused on keeping you on track to your goals, being proactive on financial issues, and helping you make smart choices about your money along the way within your normal financial routine. So we're not looking for trouble. we're not looking for financial issues necessarily, although you could. My point is, these are the main bottom line outcomes. This is where your ideal client, in my opinion, must value at least one of these three outcomes enough to pay your entire compensation. And if ever you have a client that who's not used to, this happens quite often, where a client has never paid an advisor as high as what they're paying you. So they just, you know, they don't have any context. They don't know what you should be doing. So having conversations like this where you go on record as saying these are the three things we do, and so that your client's not looking for work for you to do because they just feel like you're charging enough that they need to be coming up with things for you to do to be worth what they're paying you. No, this is your ability to articulate and check back with them. These are the three things we do, and you as a client have to value at least one of these three outcomes enough to pay our entire fee. And that's the way it works. So your job is to be able to articulate this, but I tend to focus on articulating this to your team, because where the stakes are highest is convincing and inspiring your team to step up and do their best work, and to make the case that your team needs to continually be delivering more and more value to clients within these three outcomes. And basically, our job as a team is to keep improving until we're indispensable, until the client says, hey, you and your team are indispensable. So as a leader, it's your job to ensure that your team is continuing to stretch and grow professionally within these three outcomes. Keep pushing your team, because they will get to a point where they might even propose to you, hey, the clients are getting plenty, you know, for what they're paying. You know, this is we're providing plenty of service. In other words, they're trying to talk you into not need it, that there is not a need to improve, and basically it's your job to continue getting your team, your subject matter experts, to be willing to stretch and grow and improve professionally within these three client outcomes until your referrals increase measurably. That's the measure. I mean, you can basically explain to your team, we will know when we are at the client's expectations. In other words, we'll know when we have arrived at the standard that our clients expect, when our ideal clients just cannot resist talking us up to their friends. In other words, we'll know that we're at the level that we need to be when our clients can't resist introducing us to everyone that they know and they love and they care about. And until then, we have tons of room for improvement. And so it's to reset this with your team unless we're getting more referrals than we can handle, then you as a team have much room for improvement. And it's your job as a leader to make that case. So that's it for this month's edition of the Advisor Pack Monthly Session. I'm Mark Little. Until next month, as always, we wish you all the best in implementing.